This is The Point on CAI. I'm Steve Junker. It's Friday, June 14th. This is our weekly local news roundup. We'll be discussing the week's top stories with reporters and editors from around the region. Today on the program, we'll be hearing from CAI's Jeanette Barnes and Eve Zuckoff. We'll speak to Louisa Hufstetter of the Vineyard Gazette and Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle. We'll check in with Paul Benson of the Provincetown Independent and Josh Balling of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. CAI's Patrick Flannery is speaking to our State House correspondent Katie Lannan, and we'll hear from Colin Hogan of the New Bedford Light. And now to some of the news around the Cape, the coast, and the islands. Senator Markey has a lot of questions about the Cape Cod bridges. But first, safety risks at the Pilgrim Nuclear Power Station are back in the spotlight this week. This time it's about a plant worker exposed to radiation. It was enough to set off an alarm as the person went to leave a controlled area of the reactor building. CAI's Jeanette Barnes joins us now with those stories and more. Hi, Jeanette.
Hi, Steve.
This seems to have been an unusual exposure incident at Pilgrim. Is that right?
Well, I'm not sure how frequently unintended exposure to radiation happens at the plant, but this is the first time in the several years that I've been covering Pilgrim that I've heard of someone getting enough to set off an alarm. What happened is that a worker at Pilgrim was conducting a radiological survey, kind of like a routine monitoring of what is called the head of the reactor vessel, which is like the top cap area. And the worker inadvertently contacted the head of the vessel, which caused particles on it to become airborne. When I heard about this, I asked the spokesman for the company that owns Pilgrim, Holtec, to confirm it, and he did confirm this happened. He filled in some of those details. This is Patrick O'Brien from Holtec. He said the radiation then did set off an alarm when the person went to pass through the exit of this radiologically controlled space where this work was being done.
As you say, you were able to verify the radiation exposure happened, but talk a little bit about how you got this information, because it was revealed in an anonymous letter. And this is the third such letter since last summer.
Yes, it is. And the letter contains some other safety allegations that Holtec denies. It says that staff cuts were a factor. It says that people didn't have some detection equipment they needed, but Holtec denies both of those claims. So I want to say that. But we have learned some interesting things from these letters in the past that CAI has been able to confirm. In one of the earlier letters, we found out that submerged heaters had been installed at Pilgrim, and they were causing the radioactive water in the plant to evaporate faster. So the community activists are calling the author of this letter, this latest letter, a whistleblower. By the way, the letter says it's by the same person from one of the previous letters. So the community activists are calling this person a whistleblower. But I do want to say that, you know, whether or not that person works at Pilgrim or anything about their identity has not been verified. So that's one reason that as journalists, we are being very careful to see what we can verify. In the past, Holtec has questioned this idea of the whistleblower by saying that the information in the letters was already public information, that it could be found somewhere in documents or something like that. This time, it's not really clear if that is the case. No one has indicated to me that any public document showed this information before this letter was postmarked, which was May 14th. That date is according to the local group Cape Down Winders, which received a copy of the letter, and so did the Department of Public Health.
We know that staff at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission inspect Pilgrim regularly. They're supposed to be notified of any safety events. What did they have to say?
They said they did receive notice, but they do not consider this to be an overexposure. I talked to the spokesman for the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, Neil Sheehan, and he says exposure to radiation at a plant does not equal overexposure, because nuclear plant employees are actually legally allowed to receive 5,000 millirems of radiation a year from occupational exposure. So the federal government is going to be looking at this incident as part of their routine inspections. But Sheehan says it is not at the level where they would conduct an extra inspection specifically for this incident. Also, Holtec says they are doing their own internal investigation that is independent of the supervisor who was involved in this work, because the reason I mentioned that is that there was another allegation in the letter that a supervisor involved in this work had been the person who initially reviewed what happened.
I guess one of the questions here is whether this situation has implications for these larger questions about how to safely clean up the Pilgrim property and make it appropriate for redevelopment.
Yeah, well, the director of Cape Downwinders, Diane Turco, is calling for a state investigation of this situation, but the Department of Public Health would only say that they forwarded the letter to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, to that federal agency. And an official from the State Department of Public Health told me that the NRC, that federal agency, is the appropriate agency for this material. So it really doesn't sound like this letter on its own is going to inspire any kind of action by the state. But the activists have, a number of other fronts. They're putting pressure on the Healey administration and especially the Department of Environmental Protection to find some kind of way to stop Holtec from releasing the plant's radioactive water, either directly into Cape Cod Bay as water, as liquid, or through the evaporation that is ongoing at the plant. And really, everyone on all sides of this is still waiting to see if the state DEP is going to finalize the draft decision it made last year, which was to deny a water discharge permit that Pilgrim needed. So that denial was issued in draft form almost a year ago, and it has not been finalized for reasons that are going unexplained at this point.
Let's turn to the Cape Cod bridges right now. Senator Ed Markey put the bridges on his schedule last Friday when he visited Bourne to get an update on the project. You were there. First, tell us what this event was like.
Sure, yes. It was like an abbreviated version of the open house that happened in May. This time they only used half of the gym there at the community center, but many of the same posters were on display showing the arch style bridge, and what some of the local road connections could be. Senator Markey got a one-on-one explanation of those posters, mainly from the project manager, Brian Cordero. But the state highway administrator, Jonathan Gulliver, was in attendance, and so was the transportation secretary, Monica Tibbetts-Nutt. So they had some comments as well.
You've been covering this all along. Did anything new come out at this meeting on Friday?
Sadly, no. This really was to give Senator Markey that one-on-one time to get the update on it. And perhaps I think also it may have been to keep up the local push for federal support, at least in the eyes of some of the folks in attendance there, because there was a pretty good sized contingent of local interests there showing support. People like town officials from the town of Bourne, staff from more than one of our local chambers of commerce, Senator Sue Moran, and so forth. A lot of folks.
You also reported this week about a new facility the state is planning to open in New Bedford focused on ocean-based renewable energy. That could include not just offshore wind, but also wave energy and tidal energy. It's going to be like a commerce center. Tell us more about how this is going to work.
Sure. So the idea is a part business incubator for startups, part office and networking space, and then also a place for the bigger established companies in this industry to house some of their perhaps research and development or other space. Again, this is all focused on renewable energy that's based in the ocean. It's being led by a state economic development agency called the Massachusetts Clean Energy Center. And as you said, it's not limited to wind, but to anything ocean-based, perhaps things like waves and tidal energy. Those are the most common ones other than wind. The plan is to locate this facility somewhere on the New Bedford waterfront with very roughly 30,000 square feet of space. The state is not ready to announce the exact location, But Bruce Carlyle, who works at the Clean Energy Center, tells me that they're in the final stages right now of securing some kind of agreement for a location.
And this is going to be supported by a mix of public and private funding, right?
After the initial startup, then yes, the state is funding it at $10 million for capital expenses and some portion of the operations for the first few years. After that, they're planning to support it with a blend of public dollars and private funding, mainly through lease payments. And Bruce Carlyle says a lot of those lease payments will be coming from what they call the anchor tenants, those larger established businesses, because startups will have their leases subsidized at first to help with the startup, and then that subsidy will be gradually reduced. Also, I want to mention that for any businesses listening who may be interested in being part of this, today actually is the deadline to express that interest in writing to the state, but it's non-binding at this point. So people would not be creating any kind of obligation for themselves at this point to follow through, but time to express interest.
That is CAI's Jeanette Barnes. Thanks, Jeanette.
All right. Thank you, Steve.
This is the news roundup on The Point. I'm Steve Junker. We're going to take a quick break now. When we come back, we'll speak with CAI's Eve Zukoff. Stay with us. This is the news roundup on The Point. We're talking about the top local stories of the week with reporters and editors from around the region. I'm Steve Junker. This week, the Senate considered a federal funding package that includes an extension for the proposed machine gun range on Joint Base Cape Cod. CAI's Eve Zukoff reports that it saw some major pushback. Eve joins us now. Hi, Eve.
Hi, Steve.
Walk us through the basics here first. What was at stake this week for this proposed machine gun range?
Sure. So the Massachusetts Army National Guard has been pursuing this controversial machine gun range project for years now, and the Guard successfully had secured a nearly $10 million authorization, like a bucket of money to build this thing. That's not the full cost to build the range, but it's a significant portion of the total. But the funds expire in September. That's 4 months from now. And obviously, there's a long way to go to actually get this thing fully approved. So first, the House of Representatives considered extending the funding through language in the 2025 National Defense Authorization Act by 1 year. So the funds would expire instead September 2025. But then, with advocacy from Representative Bill Keating, our congressman, that extension language was taken out of the House side. Now, this week, the Senate looked at their version of the bill, and just like we asked Keating about his position ahead of time, we asked Senator Elizabeth Warren about her position, and she actually does have a real position of power here as the chair of the Committee on Armed Services.
So what did she say about the range and this extended funding issue?
Well, for a few days, nothing, but pressure was mounting. The Barnstable County Commissioners voted last week to send the senator a letter urging her to ensure the funding extension request was not included in the final bill. Plus, the Association to Preserve Cape Cod launched an email campaign urging its supporters to email Warren with the same message. So when we reached out, we did finally get a statement from her. She said her position has always been that we need to follow the science and that the Environmental Protection Agency is currently working to determine if the range could contaminate the Cape's sole source aquifer. The EPA has already said in a draft report, yes, it could contaminate this aquifer that gives all of us our drinking water. So ultimately, she says, quote, I oppose any effort to move forward with the gun range until the EPA reaches its final determination, including extending authorities in the annual defense policy bill.
Mm. So she came out with quite a position there, but what actually happened when the Senate went through this bill?
Well, okay, there was this markup of the bill on Wednesday, and this is very strange, but we don't know what happened during that process. The Senate looks at these things privately. We may get a press release from the Armed Services Committee today that reveals the results, but we were also told we may not know about kind of the final language here until July, when the whole Senate looks at this bill, not just the subcommittee. Again, it's a really bizarre feature of what you might expect to be an open process. I've been scratching my head at this for the last few days.
It's been interesting that this process has also been a little bit of a lesson in how government works, like how something gets funded and how funds get extended and how political pressure enters that process and starts to influence our our representatives in their role in all of this.
Yeah, yeah. It's some limits of democracy and also some interesting lessons in how, you know, constituents really can make a difference, too.
Okay, we know that you will keep following that, but I guess this one funding that's sort of in suspension, this doesn't kill the range.
Right. The state has the final power of approval, even if the EPA does finalize their sole source aquifer report.
So it's going to go to the state at some point to get approved or not.
Exactly.
Okay, let's talk about another story that you reported this week. The Northeast Canyons and Seamounts Marine National Monument. It's a big mouthful. It's 130 miles off the coast of Cape Cod. It has a final management plan now. Tell us about this.
Sure. So the Biden administration recently released this 15-year management roadmap that outlines a permitting system for the activities that are allowed in this marine monument area. It's massive. So it includes, permitting guidance on things like sailing and birding and enforcement for what's not allowed, like commercial fishing and fossil fuel extraction. It also allows for scientific research and exploration, like developing an inventory of what species exactly live in the monument, so management can best ensure their protection. It can also contribute important information to our understanding of how climate change is changing the underwater landscape. And the last big thing is that the plan includes education and outreach and programming, like developing materials for schools and building out an internship program.
Okay, so we can think of this kind of like a national park that's offshore and underwater.
Yes.
Massive. But why is this newest round of rules that they've sort of formulated around it, so why is this so important?
Yeah, well, it's the first and only marine national monument off the continental United States. And scientists told me that it just greatly reduces, at least in the monument, the threats to marine mammals and seabirds and turtles that use all of the kind of surface waters. And it limits the commercial scale activities in the deeper waters that can harm corals and sponges and other fragile and vulnerable species. It's also finally a step forward in a very herky-jerky political process where President Obama first designated the 3.1 million acre monument in 2016. And then those protections were rolled back by President Trump, and then they were reestablished by President Biden. So this is a national monument, despite many kind of pressures from the fishing industry in particular. And we need a sense of what this monument means and what should and could happen here.
That is CAI's environment reporter, Eve Zuckoff. Eve, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Redevelopment for affordable and workforce housing is at the center of a number of interconnected stories from the Lower Cape. Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle joins us to help unravel a tangled narrative. Hi, Tim.
Hi, Steve.
Let's start in Orleans, where there have been questions raised about the selection of a developer for the Governor Prentz Inn property, which the town purchased for housing back in 2021. What's happening there?
Exactly. There was a proposals put out seeking developers to build housing at the Prentz property. The town received two proposals, one of them from the Penrose Company, which is currently redeveloping the former Cape Cod 5 facility in Orleans into about 62 units of housing. And during the period where these proposals were being reviewed, some concerns were raised about the appropriateness of some communications between the developers and Alan McLennan, who is a member of the Affordable Housing Trust Board, and also he's a member of a group that was reviewing these proposals. And a local resident made a public records request and found a bunch of emails that seemed to show inappropriate communications between Mr. McLennan and others, including the developers. And last week, he brought these proposals before the Board of Selectmen. These issues before the Select Board, and there was discussion about this. And it turned out that Mr. McLennan did resign just a few days ago from the committees that he was on, saying that there was a misunderstanding here, but he didn't want to taint the process. Mm. Now, as part of this, to make it even more complicated, Penrose Company withdrew its proposal for the Prince property, basically saying that when they had submitted the proposal, they had a specific schedule in mind for this development and other developments, but that wasn't working out anymore, and that they were no longer able to really follow the proposal that they had submitted. So that left one bidder available for the Prince project, and that it was the Preservation of Affordable Housing, Housing Assistance Corporation, and Habitat for Humanity. They submitted one bid for the together for that property. So, go ahead.
And some of the folks who were looking at this for the town were already leaning towards them as a preferred developer for the property, because feeling that while their plan might not be the least expensive for the town, it might be the most appropriate. Is that right?
That's exactly correct. And that was why there was a lot of people were mystified as to why McLennan was kept advocating for Penrose and sort of swaying his committee towards that, when consultants and other town officials said it didn't really make a lot of sense that the joint proposal by the three nonprofits would be better for the town, even though Penrose is a private developer, so they would not require the town to contribute any funds. They would would essentially buy the land from the town, and they would use affordable housing tax credits as financing. But the other organizations would look to the town for some financial help. That sort of, even despite that, many people, as you said, Steve, felt that that was the better proposal, and were sort of surprised that Penrose was being elevated. So now that will happen. What's also interesting is that Penrose is behind a number of other proposals that are in the works right now. They submitted a proposal for a affordable housing development in Harwich, and they're also under consideration for two properties in Chatham. They are at this point the recommended vendor for to develop those properties. An evaluation group in Chatham, composed of members of the Select Board and the Affordable Housing Trust, recommended Penrose over several other developers who submitted proposals for the two separate properties. There was a little bit of blowback against that at the Select Board meeting this past week, where a number of people said that, again, some of the other proposals they felt were better for the town, and they urged that the Penrose one not be accepted. We're hopefully going to find out what happens with that next Tuesday. The town manager in Chatham, Jill Goldsmith, is the procurement officer who makes that final recommendation. And she has the, even though Penrose has been recommended by an evaluation committee, she says she's still reviewing the different proposals, and she'll have a decision soon, we're hoping, by next week.
There's a lot there. You can read all about it in the Cape Cod Chronicle. That's Tim Wood. Tim, thanks so much.
Thank you, Steve.
A new nonprofit is proposing a major development for Vineyard Haven's working waterfront. Louisa Hufstetter, the Vineyard Gazette, has this story and joins us. Hi, Louisa.
Hi, Steve. Yes, it's going to be kind of a working and playing waterfront, as envisioned by the nonprofit Vineyard Lands for Community,
There's a lot to explain here. Let me just jump in and say, maybe start describing the area that's being eyed for transformation so people who maybe aren't as familiar can imagine what they're proposing here.
Absolutely. So the infamous Five Corners intersection, which is the first thing many people encounter when arriving on the Vineyard in Vineyard Haven by the steamship, goes out of town towards Oak Bluffs along Beach Road, which was recently got a semi-cosmetic overhaul by the Department of Transportation, but is still a low road in danger of sea level rise. Nonetheless, it has harbored many, so to speak, many businesses over the years. Right now, there's an MV Times newspaper office is part of this project, too. Art galleries, all housed in buildings that went up in the early years of the U.S. involvement in World War II. One of the buildings, for instance, made boat silhouettes so people could spot U-boats easily from shore and things like that. And it continues. There's a private park right in the middle of this parcel or this spot. It's owned by the auto magnate Ernie Bach Jr., and it's currently gated and locked, but he has given his permission for the nonprofit to include it in the designs. And so through the regulatory process, at least, while they try to work out a longer-term relationship. And so there would be an amphitheater and a big public park for concerts and things. And then on the other side, where the galleries currently are, there would be about a 25,000 square foot raised building with artist studios for about a dozen artists and craftsmen. In the middle of it all, also, I forgot to mention, next to or closer to the waterfront from the newspaper office is the Gannon and Benjamin Marine Railway, which is the island's wooden boat building shop owned by Nat Benjamin and Ross Gannon. That would expand and be more visible to the public. As part of this current plan, this is just beginning its regulatory odyssey now.
Okay,
so we can expect some changes.
So this proposal that, as you say, is just kind of being brought forward here is really to try to rethink that whole stretch of waterfront and make it more publicly accessible, make it really a place where people can gather and come and feel at home there on the waterfront. Tell us about the nonprofit that's come into life to create this. Who's behind this and what are they looking for here?
The primary movers are Steve Bernier, who is the former owner and still manages Kronig's Markets, and he's the chairman of the board. And Phil Wallace, who's the former director of the Martha's Vineyard Museum, he presided and sort of shepherded the museum for the process of moving from Edgartown, renovating a big old building in Vineyard Haven and moving there. That went well. This is another level of complexity, he told me, but Phil Wallace is actually the executive director, and there's a small all-local board, local council, working with local architect, design builder, and engineer, all local team. By the way, Phil also told me that they intend to pay taxes. They're not going to be one of these nonprofits that just exists without paying its way. That is what he told me.
What happens next? What's the next step here? They have like these preliminary drawings and designs, and they've announced an intention. How do they start to put this in motion?
Well, they start with the Conservation Commission in Vineyard Haven. That's the first stop. They will almost immediately be referred and automatically be referred to the Martha's Vineyard Commission, our regional land planning agency, and there will be public hearings. And once the Vineyard Commission, if the commission approves it to go forward as a development of regional impact, then the town, again, will have the town regulatory agencies, planning board and so forth, will have at it. State agencies, the coastal management, will need to look at it because part of the job will involve some fill in order to raise this building they want. They want to build this raised building and have 30 covered parking spaces underneath. So there will be a lot of chances for the public to look at these designs, to weigh in on them, and for regulators to do their thing. And the nonprofit, actually, they're prepared for this. And they formed really not just to tackle this particular property. It was learning that the DeSourcy family, who own the properties on either side of Mr. Bach's park, were going to put the land on the market, which it's really been out there for quite a long time, but it seemed to be nearing reality. And so the nonprofit, having seen other kind of iconic properties and high-profile places go to private developers over the years, was formed basically to keep that from happening and to develop it in a way that's for the islanders instead. So, because some developers were commercial developers were coming in to look at the property, there could have been condos, hotels, retailers, restaurants, a marina, all sorts of things could have gone there.
Louisa,
and still could if they don't raise $5 million by the closing date, August 1st.
We have to leave it there. Louisa Hufstetter of the Vineyard Gazette, where you can read all about it. Louisa, thanks so much.
Thank you, Steve. Bye-bye.
The idea of a transfer fee on high-dollar property sales to be directed toward affordable and workforce housing has receded a bit at the State House, where a major housing bill is being considered. On the Outer Cape, many are still holding out hope for it, that it can be revived. Paul Benson of the Provincetown Independent joins us with this story. Hi, Paul.
Hi, Steve.
Paul, Sarah Peake, the Outer Cape state rep, has been an advocate of the transfer fee. Explain the fee briefly, I guess, and what's the hope for what it could do for the Outer Cape?
Sure. The real estate transfer fee is charged above typically the first million in a real estate transaction. In some cases, it's a higher threshold on Nantucket. And it's either 1% or 2%, could be as low as 0.5%. Some towns have asked for it to be charged to the buyer, some to the seller. And the idea is that that extra money charged on these high-dollar real estate transactions are diverted specifically for housing. And especially on the island of Nantucket or Martha's Vineyard, that's been the funding model that produced the Conservation Land Trust over the course of the last four decades. All of this conservation land has been purchased. You know, there's no national park on the islands, but they're still very deeply conserved because it's raised, you know, tens of millions of dollars with real estate transfer fees. So they're requesting the state to be able to do the same to fund housing efforts.
And it's an idea that's been out there for a while, but it does require the State House to sign off on it. And the State House has never done this, but it seems to have been gathering momentum in this last year. And even the governor has come out and said that she kind of endorses the idea, at least in theory. But there's been pushback as well. The State House didn't include the transfer fee in its version of this, but now the State Senate is looking at it. And as I said, the state rep there, Sarah Peake of Provincetown, is hopeful that maybe it can get worked back into the bill. What do we know about where this is at?
Yes, so we spoke to the chair of the Coalition to Create a Martha's Vineyard Housing Bank, who said that the Governor Healey had been to Martha's Vineyard just the day after the House passed their bill, and that the governor was still very committed to the real estate transfer fee. Mm-hmm. So if there's still rounds in this fight, it would be if the State Senate adds it in to their bill, and then it goes to a conference committee where six people will decide the ultimate shape of the legislation. So that's where the House and Senate would have to come to an agreement on whether to include or not include a transfer fee.
You talked to some folks in the real estate. Not everyone in the real estate world is in favor of this. There's some real pushback here. Explain what their point of view is.
Yes, we spoke to Ryan Castle. He's head of the Cape Cod and Islands Association of Realtors. The Massachusetts, the State Association of Realtors, has been very clear in their testimony against this bill. And they tend to say that it would raise real estate costs further. It would make it harder for people to get into their first home. That it could have bad effects on diversity if it makes it harder to get into a first home, maybe reinforce segregation patterns. And also that it could decrease sales volume, which would hurt realtors in particular, and conceivably property prices writ large.
And again, just to sort of underscore this, this is a fee or a tax that would be put on very high dollar, over $1 million or more sales, and only on that amount over that threshold, whether that's $1 million or more, that the actual tax would apply to, not to the whole sale.
That is correct.
It's so a little complicated, yeah.
Yeah, a $1.2 million sale, you're only taxing the $200,000 part.
Right.
If you tax it at 1%, it's $2,000 tax on a $1.2 million transfer.
And how about Julian Sear, state senator there from the Outer Cape region? What's his take on if this is going to appear in the next version of this?
He is pushing really hard with Senate leadership, is what he said, to include this in the bill. There's a lot of senators. There's from all over the state. And what makes the real estate transfer fee sort of both complicated and interesting is it really addresses the crisis that is specific to the Cape and Islands and the Berkshires, where extremely high-value real estate is not attainable to the incomes of the people who live here. So, yes, the real estate values are very high, but people who earn incomes on Cape or on Island can rarely afford that real estate. It doesn't work everywhere because not everyone has real estate value over $1 million. Mm-hmm. So there are towns in the center of the state that are like, well, why should I vote for this if it doesn't affect my town? You know, we don't have any transfers over that amount.
And
so persuading legislators has been tricky.
And one of the last little pieces of this is that the towns would have to opt in. So this isn't something that the state passes and all. It applies everywhere. If you want it, they're essentially asking for the permission to be able to opt in for this, the towns.
Yes. And Boston is the big X factor in that. Boston, the tax would be worth something like $70 million a year. Which would be coming on very high-value commercial property in a lot of cases. Also some very high-value residential property. You know, there are $4 and $5 million properties in Boston. Mm. So that is where a lot of the source of opposition is, because the people who would have to pay that tax, of course, are not interested in doing so.
It's Paul Benson of the Provincetown Independent. Paul, thanks so much.
Always a pleasure. Thanks, Steve.
You're listening to the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we'll hear from Josh Balling of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. Stay with us. This is the local news roundup on The Point. I'm Steve Junker. We are talking about the top local stories of the week with colleagues in the print and digital media. On Nantucket, a proposed expansion of the airport has created a lot of angst and opposition from neighbors, but it is moving ahead with plans for a wall to mitigate noise and fumes. Josh Balling of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror joins us to catch us up. Hi, Josh.
Good morning.
This wall is to go where initially a massive earth berm was proposed. Is that right?
That is correct. And that berm was intended to be built with some encapsulated PFAS-laden soil in the middle of it as a disposal method. And that got neighbors quite upset and quite angry. And they have been showing up at the Airport Commission meetings a couple of times over the last few months to protest that. And so the Airport Commission just recently approved $700,000 for the engineering, design, and bid process of a noise barrier that would be constructed from either wood or plastic and steel to mitigate the effects of noise and fumes from nearby residential areas. It was the first major step in building the replacement for the PFAS berm, as it was called, that neighbors had objected to, that was connected to the expansion of a parking area for private jets. Some commission members were a little taken aback by the proposed cost of the project, total cost of $5
million. That's the $5 million just for the wall? Is that right?
$5 million just for the wall.
Okay, yeah.
Massive undertaking for the entire expansion project, which is already well underway. But $5 million just for the wall. They thought that was quite a bit, but they said they have made a promise to the neighbors that they would do everything they could to mitigate the noise and the fumes, so they're going to go ahead with at least the $700,000 for the engineering and design and permitting, and take the $5 million request, or whatever it ends up being, to town meeting next year.
Mm. But in the meantime, as you say, that whole project is charging right ahead, the airport
is
work.
Forward.
Yeah. We have talked about the so-called new downtown development for the Mid-Island. It's a significant commercial building or series of buildings nestled together. What's the latest here?
The latest is that the Historic District Commission has been holding hearings on the exterior design of the project after it was approved by the Planning Board last year. And some of the HDC members still aren't sold on the overall look of it, despite developers scaling down the project quite significantly over the last several months. It did appear that the commission was poised to approve the project prior to its meeting on Tuesday, but they ultimately continued it as members requested some more revisions. The current plans call for two buildings on six lots that stretch along Sparks Avenue across from the Stop and Shop supermarket. The main building of about 12,000 square feet would consist of an 8-lane bowling alley, a relocated Downey Flake restaurant on the first floor, and then apartments totaling 35 bedrooms on the second and third floors. And a second building about half that size would contain retail space and apartments on the first floor and apartments on the second and third floors. Also new to the proposal that did not come out of the planning board process was an outdoor pedestrian seating area in front of the main building. And these plans are vastly different from what was approved by the Planning Board in November, and much, much different than what was originally proposed 3 years ago, which included a much larger structure with an Apple store, a health club, a couple of restaurant spaces, rental office space, and apartments as well. So it's a much different project, and it's moving toward approval, but it's unclear exactly when that might be yet. The developers are going to come back with a revised proposal sometime probably before the end of the summer.
It's Josh Balling of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. Josh, thank you.
Thank you.
The state's emergency shelter system is changing, and soon many families may be evicted. Also, legislation is promising an update to the state's parenting laws for LGBTQ+ families. Morning Edition host Patrick Flannery spoke with our State House correspondent Katie Lannon about the week's biggest stories from Beacon Hill. Here's their conversation.
Hello there, Katie.
Hey there.
Massachusetts was the first state to legalize same-sex marriage, but when it comes to parenting, it seems like it's taken a long time to get to laws that address the rights of LGBTQ couples regarding their families and how they grow. So what did the House decide this week, and what changes for families?
Yeah, and it's interesting you bring up that 20-year anniversary of marriage equality, because we heard this week from Representative Sarah Peek of Provincetown, who said that as someone who benefited from marriage equality, she assumed these issues of parentage for LGBTQ families would have been nailed down with that. But that's not the case, lawmakers say. So they passed a bill in the House this week that would set clear pathways for how a non-biological parent, someone who's not biologically related to their child, think in LGBTQ couples or families that use IVF or surrogacy, can make sure their legal rights as a parent and their child's rights are protected through that structure. The idea is, according to House lawmakers, that the state's laws haven't kept up with the diverse ways that people build families now.
Katie, tell us about the state's new campaign advising residents to avoid what are known as anti-abortion centers. These appear to be medical clinics, but they're not. And this comes a couple of years following the overturning of Roe versus Wade. What's behind all this?
Yeah, the state officials who launched this campaign this week really did tie this issue into the anti-abortion movement more broadly. They say these facilities, also known as crisis pregnancy centers, sometimes use deceptive tactics to dissuade people from having abortions, to keep them coming back to that same facility. And, you know, they say the state leaders who are launching this campaign advising residents to seek full-spectrum reproductive care elsewhere say that that's how the anti-abortion movement operates in states like ours where there are strong reproductive health laws. Of course, the association that does represent these centers is knocking the campaign as something that's politically motivated.
Katie, families living in the state's emergency shelter system could be evicted by fall. What's new with the process? Are there no more extensions for families who have either migrated here or are considered unhoused?
In keeping with the law that passed earlier this year, families that get these exit notices will be able to get extensions in certain circumstances. If it's, you know, if there's an immunocompromised family member, if there's a baby in the family, things like that. But the state is moving ahead with this time limit of 9-month stays in shelters, and they're going to start rolling out notices to families this summer, advising some that they're going to have to leave come September, as early as September 29th, possibly. And that's something that the state is putting in place to help manage the overwhelming demand for shelter. There are about 4,000 families who have been in shelters for more than 9 months, and state elected leaders have long said this is unsustainable.
Finally, Senator Warren had some words this week for the relationship between corporate executives and healthcare. Much of this is stemming from what's going on with Steward Healthcare, which operates several hospitals in Massachusetts, including one in Fall River. Steward is in bankruptcy court. What's the latest with this company, and do Warren's words really mean much?
They could mean much if she can get, you know, the rest of the Senate and Congress to back the new bill she's filing that would target what she describes as executives who loot hospitals and other healthcare facilities, who profit off of stripping resources from their facilities at the risk of patient care. This would not apply directly to the Steward hospitals here in Massachusetts, but in cases going forward. And as the senator and state-level lawmakers pursue Steward-inspired legislation, there are still a lot of questions about what's going to happen to those handful of hospitals here in Massachusetts, whether another buyer will be found as those sites proceed to auction this summer. So it's really not sure who will step in and what steps the state might take to ensure that patients and employees across Massachusetts are kept at the forefront.
That's Katie Lannon from the State House. Katie, as always, thanks for your time and your insight.
Thank you.
That was our Morning Edition host, Patrick Flannery, speaking with our State House correspondent, Katie Lannon. This is the News Roundup on The Point. I'm Steve Junker. The School Committee of New Bedford has approved almost $700,000 for weapons detectors to be put at the entrances of the high school in the city. It has been a controversial decision. Colin Hogan of the New Bedford Light joins us with this story. Hi, Colin.
Hi, good morning.
Colin, tell us about these machines. These are something like the security that you pass through when entering, what, like a major sporting event or something like that?
Yeah, that's exactly right. There's metal detectors, but they're actually advanced and have some AI features on them, which the company Evolve says helps them to detect weapons without being as invasive and having people empty their pockets. The Boston Globe ran a story that these are the same detectors that are being used at Fenway and TD Garden, but they're not without controversy either. Some of the reports about these machines is that they don't work as effectively as the company claims. Hmm. So it did cause some controversy as it was passed by the school committee last week.
Also controversy about the message that it's sending, right? That this is an allocation of a lot of money and resources to some people saying to keep the school safe, but also sending a message to kids as they're passing into the school that they're passing through these weapons detectors.
Yeah, what Mayor John Mitchell said in his comments supporting the purchase of these weapons detectors is that other schools already have these. There's weapons detectors in Fall River and in Taunton. So nearby cities have some similar technology. And what he said is that we are a society now where bad things happen in public places. He said, if anything, New Bedford might be behind the times. But during the public comments of the school committee meeting, you're exactly right. Students came forward and said, we don't want to be in a school where we feel like we're treated like criminals. Some teachers also testified that they felt this could send the wrong message about the community. It was a decision that also happened quickly. We're at year end and the school committee is trying to spend down funds. So this purchase actually came as a result of a transfer of funds and is happening at the end of the year. And there were also some comments that maybe this should be done as part of a plan rather than using extra funds at year's end. But the purchase ended up being approved 5-2 by the school committee, and the metal detectors, weapons detectors, will be operational at New Bedford High School as soon as this fall.
Tell us a little bit more about these actual units. They are in use, as you say, at some schools, but there's still questions about how effective they are.
Yeah, so some of the controversy that's come up about Evolve, which is the company that produces these machines, is that they're not as effective as the company might claim. The BBC did an investigation that found 42% of large knives were not found by these machines, which, again, use cameras to assist their metal detector, so it's less invasive and people walking through don't have to empty their pockets. But the study was ensured that it would actually find all the things it claimed it would find. And so the FTC has opened, the Federal Trade Commission, has opened an investigation about the claims this company has made. Is it as effective as they say? Do they really work as well as they do? And that is an open question. That investigation is ongoing.
And how does this fit into the school's overall, you know, efforts to have increased security or lean into having an increased security in the schools?
Yeah, well, New Bedford this spring has actually made two large investments into school security. This $700,000 transfer for weapons detectors comes only a month or two after the school committee approved a $400,000 transfer for new security cameras. Those security cameras at New Bedford High will also use AI, or it's a company that markets its product based on its AI capabilities, at least. And those cameras can track facial recognition and see where students are moving throughout the building and produce automated reports about who's in the building. So large investments, $400,000 for cameras, $700,000 for weapons detectors, have happened during this year-end process of transferring money to make sure that all dollars are spent. And some critics have said, we want more transparency about why these decisions are being made instead of the year-end spend down.
Is there a sense of when these things could be installed? Will they be there for the fall?
Yeah, the weapons detectors will be online for the fall, and the security cameras likely will be installed by then, too. So New Bedford students will have a different morning experience, different morning routines when they return to school in September.
That is Colin Hogan of the New Bedford Light, where you can see images of these machines and some of what they're trying to accomplish there. Colin, thanks so much.
Thank you.
That's our show for today. I want to thank my guests. We heard from CAI's Jeanette Barnes and Eve Zuckoff. We spoke with Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle and Louisa Hufstetter of the Vineyard Gazette. We checked in with Paul Benson of the Provincetown Independent and Josh Balling of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. CAI's Patrick Flannery spoke to our State House correspondent Katie Lannon, and we heard from Colin Hogan there from the New Bedford Light. Big thanks to Dan Treidel for engineering the program. The News Roundup is a Jenga tower ready to topple at any moment, if not for his steady hand with every piece. Thanks, Dan. Thank you for listening. In Woods Hole, I'm Steve Junker. Talk to you next week.